conceptualize a little bit of what it is that we will be doing. Some of you have been here throughout the weekend, and some of you, this is your first time showing up. So I want to let you know that I have the privilege of teaching an Arba Ne Mitzvah Chavurah at Temple Beth El, which is several hours of family education that lead up to our children becoming Bar and Bat Mitzvah. And one thing that consistently comes up is how much parents and grandparents want to care for their children and grandchildren. Certainly they want to provide for them, but more importantly, parents want to impart in their children and grandchildren values, especially how Judaism can teach them how to become caring, giving, and socially conscious human beings. And yet parents are also grappling with the question of what kind of world will we be leaving our children and our grandchildren? And what can we do to help make our world better? And that's what this weekend is about, as we start to explore how our deepest passions can help us address our deepest concerns. This weekend represents Temple Beth El's entry into the world of congregation-based community organizing, a process which begins with personal conversations between a congregation's own members about their deepest concerns, and then culminates in the ability to implement our Jewish values by effectively implementing what we need to do to create the necessary change in our society. That's why we've been calling this weekend not just another conversation, but a conversation for change. An opportunity for us to deepen relationships with our fellow congregants through joint exploration of our community values and to create meaningful relationships across racial, religious, and economic lines, and to find specific and meaningful opportunities to impact public policy within Westchester County. Our congregation is one of 50 in Westchester taking this journey together, and there is no better person to help guide us through this journey and to inspire us to help prepare our world than my good friend, Rabbi Jonah Pesner. Rabbi Jonah Dov Pesner is the founding director of Just Congregations of the Union for Reform Judaism. Rabbi Pesner works with synagogues pursuing social justice across the country and teaches on all three campuses of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. He's led congregations and organizations in successful campaigns for healthcare access, affordable housing, public education, gay and lesbian rights, workers' rights, and living wage. As a leader of the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, Rabbi Pesner was the chair of the GBIO effort in the Massachusetts Affordable Care Today Coalition that successfully secured health care for more than 500,000 uninsured residents of the Commonwealth. Rabbi Pesner chairs the Board of Jewish Organizing Initiative and has served on the boards of the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the Jewish Memorial Hospital. He's written several wonderful journal articles and wrote a chapter entitled Redemption for Radicals in the anthology Righteous Indignation. He served as the assistant rabbi of Temple Israel of Westport, Connecticut, and then associate rabbi at Temple Israel of Boston when I had the privilege of being one of his congregants when I lived in Boston. He was also the Meyer W. Nathan Scholar at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, where he was ordained in 1997. A graduate of Wesleyan University, Rabbi Pesner is married to Boston attorney Dana S. Gershon. Together they have four daughters, Juliet, Noah, Bobby, and Kate. This morning, as you will see, is going to be a working session. So I'm actually going to ask Sarah and Becky and Julia, if you can find a table where there are other people around here as well. We'd love to be able to have you join either this table or that table, if there are no babysitting. So if we can ask you to do that, because this is going to be a working meeting here. So you can join together or separate out.
They're all close, but not mitzvah.
And are wonderful, wonderful leaders of our youth group and our high school program. So any table that you want to join. This morning we're going to be learning about and engaging in the types of conversation which constitute the building blocks of community organizing. And so to explore with us how kids and parents can change the world, community organizing within religious education. I'm thrilled to welcome my close friend, Rabbi Jonah Pesner.
He was a very good congregant. He came to Torah study on Shabbos. He was a rabbi's dream. Of course, he became a rabbi, so he is a wonderful, wonderful rabbi. This has been a great weekend, and it's a little bit sad because it's starting to come to a close.
So let me just get a sense of who has been with us for the beginning. If you were here Friday night for Shabbat services, just raise your hand so I know who's heard the spiel before. Okay, so about half. And I know I recognize the faces from yesterday morning. So for people that are hearing my shtick for the first time, you're a little bit jumping on a train that is out of the station. And for folks that have been with me all weekend, is it moving pretty quickly? Yeah, it's moving fast. So there's going to be things that you sort of scratch your head and say, what is he talking about? Right? It's the way that this congregation-based community organizing operates. That's a mouthful. Congregation-based community organizing is a little bit countercultural, a little bit different than the way we normally operate. So it takes a few times. Could the people who have been on the planning team just raise your hands for a second? Okay, so the people that are raising their hands, can you confirm that it takes a couple times before you begin to sort of get it? Yeah, Susan's like nodding, yes, definitely. So I want to out these people as the people that when you're being too polite to ask me questions because you have no clue what I'm talking about, the people raising their hands, go up to them afterwards and say, what did he mean by congregation-based community organizing anyway? Or what was he talking about with all those conversations? Or what was that thing about an action? Because they're starting to get it a little bit. Let me start at the end. So the piece of my bio that Jeff did not read is the most important part. Dana and I have four daughters, Juliet, Noah, Bobby, and Kate. Their ages 11, 8, 5, and 5. We live in a suburb of Massachusetts, of Boston, called Newton, which is a lot like Chappaqua. And at 4 o'clock this afternoon, I become not scholar in residence, but soccer dad. And I will be flying up 84 to the Mass Pike to make sure to be at my daughter's soccer game. So at 12:15 sharp, I'm going to end our conversation and invite you to continue it, not only today, but as I think the rabbis have articulated, this is a conversation for change. So it will be an unfolding conversation. Keep going, keep talking, and let me have stirred up the pot this weekend. Let me also say the reason why it's so important that I frame this morning in terms of my four daughters is I'm a member of, I'm not a rabbi in a synagogue anymore, and there's been some confusion over the weekend what I do. I actually run my own group called Just Congregations. It's a program of the Union for Reformed Judaism. It's a national initiative, and so what I do for a living is travel around the country training synagogues in congregation-based community organizing. So I do this work full-time. We have projects going on in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, and a few other places. And I teach at the rabbinical school on all three domestic campuses in the United States. So that's my full-time project. As a dad and as a person and as a Jew, we still belong to Temple Israel in Boston, which is the congregation where I spent almost a decade as a congregational rabbi and a rabbinic intern before that, and where I'm raising my kids. My wife is pro bono legal counsel to the congregation. We're active in the various things that go on, and my kids all attend the various educational programs there. So the reason I'm framing this morning's conversation with you is I understand what it is to be a parent of kids in a religious education program and of a synagogue membership to think about how does my work that I do, which is up here, congregation-based community organizing, right, which sounds when I tell stories like the health reform in Massachusetts, which is so political and so high level and so systemic, how does it mean something in the life of a kid who's studying for a bar and bat mitzvah and her parents? Because at the end of the day, sort of the single biggest demographic community within our member congregations are families that are working towards bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, youth group, religious education for kids. If you took a poll, I would suggest that the number one reason why most members joined Chappaqua or Bethel or the Westchester to begin with was, well, I was thinking about how to create a religious education for my family. Right? There are other reasons too, to be sure, and many of you in this room may have become part of this community for other reasons. But the single biggest plurality of reasons would probably have to do with being a family and raising kids. So I think a great deal about whether my work is really relevant and community organizing actually can be transformative in the life of families, particularly families who are participating in religious education. Okay? So I've told lots of stories over the 2 days that I've been with you that relate more to the way in which adults lead community organizing efforts and get into campaigns for things like affordable housing, the Nursing Care Workers' Rights Campaign, the Quality of Care for Elders, and the Healthcare Campaign. This morning, I'm going to focus on a couple of stories about the way this work can be transformative for kids and their parents. Okay, so for people who've been having this conversation from the beginning with me, it's sort of a new gloss on the story. And for people who are joining us for the first time, think about the power of the story, and then later go ask some of the people who are leading this effort, like, how does all this work, okay? Before I sort of get into the details of it, let me just lift up, I thought Rabbi Mittleman did a very good job of sort of explaining in a nutshell what congregation-based community organizing is, okay? It begins not with an issue or a platform agenda. It doesn't begin with health reform. It doesn't begin with affordable housing. It doesn't begin with civil rights. It begins with people. Lots of stories, one-on-one conversations, house meetings, where people share their deepest concerns, the stories that explain their values, the things that keep them up at night. And it happens in a very systematic and strategic way inside the congregation, like a campaign of conversations. And while the congregation is going through this, other institutions, churches, other synagogues, mosques, are also going through the same process. And then in a coordinated way, the religious institutions share and distill and interpret what their collective stories are so they can decide in a community like Northern Westchester, how would the faith community act together on some of the things that we've heard about, right? And they make up organizations all across the country of religious organizations that act together. So just a few miles to the south, there's a very strong organization called South Bronx Churches that transformed the South Bronx, working together. Manhattan Together represents synagogues, churches, and a Muslim community that have helped make the public schools in Manhattan better. In East New York, there's a community called East Bronx Congregation, East Brooklyn Congregations. Okay? Long Island has a group called YCAN, Long Island CAN, which has three Reformed synagogues and then lots of churches and a mosque that work together to transform Long Island. Okay? The question for this morning is, what does this work look like potentially at Bethel and with your Christian neighbors and your Muslim neighbors in this area? And particularly, what does it look like for families and for kids? So I know we have some youth group leaders here. So I'm really grateful that you came in, because I'm going to tell one story about how this work looked with teens. And we hopefully have some parents of kids who are in the religious education program, because I'm going to talk a little bit about how it looks in religious schools. Okay? That's all a long introduction. You good? Because we're going to start. Okay. So we're going to do the same exercise that we did yesterday for people that were there, but with a little bit different. Rather than hear me talk about this work, we're going to first experience it so that we can then talk about our experience of it. Okay? So we're going to have a house meeting. A house meeting is a gathering of a group of people, like the number of people at your table, in which people share some stories so that they can help understand how they are connected to one another and some concerns that they may have in common. Okay? And we're going to ask people to share a story. And the story should articulate something that is of real concern for them right now. And particularly for those of us that have children, or for those that, well, I'll get to if you are a young person, but if for those of us that have children, a story that explains what you're really concerned about the world in which your kids are growing up. Something that you lose sleep over, given the world that your kids are increasingly inhabiting. And if you are a young person, I want you to tell a story to the people at your table about a concern that you have about the world that you're discovering as you grow into your own adulthood and your own person. What's something around you that you're experiencing that really bugs you? But here's the key, right? For people that have done this before, what do you need to tell?
Story.
A story, not give a sermon or a rant or a lecture, okay? Don't go on and on about global warming, okay? Tell a story that helps people understand why you care about global warming. I'll model this with an example. So I have four daughters. The five-year-olds were twins, obviously, are twins. And so when they were born, they both needed a variety of interventions and sort of special attention. And one of them, it turned out, really needed for a sustained period of time a lot of early intervention. And she really thrived in this program and was getting, you know, lots of at-home visits. And it was really just incredible to me to both see how she sort of blossomed and evolved and just grew so quickly and how effective the treatment was, and that we never saw a bill. And at one point over the course of this process, I sort of asked, you know, who pays for all this? And I understood that it was all state funding, that the state had made a decision using federal dollars, that it would be much better for society to treat kids early rather than have them grow up and then have much bigger problems later. And I asked what the tuition was for her treatment. It was $76,000 a year. And on the one hand, I felt overwhelmed by that number because it was so large, but on the other hand, it was easy money in the fact that it was literally saving her life. She turned three, And we went through a real tough process because all the funding moved to the town. And all of a sudden, there were lawyers involved and there was negotiation involved. And it ended well, and she continued to thrive. So much of that now, as a five-year-old, she doesn't receive any intervention at all. She has no IEP. She is completely mainstream. And everybody sort of, you know, shook hands, smiled, and went home. But part of what keeps me up at night, and part of what I'm concerned about the world that my kids are inhabiting, are twofold. One is, what if we discover in the third, fourth, or fifth grade that she has some learning issues, and we have to go through some sort of fight to get the treatment that she needs? And what if, in the budget realities that we live in, the money isn't there, and we actually have to find the money to pay for it? How could we possibly come up with something like $76,000? And the other thing that I worry about, frankly, as my kids grow, I know that because we're a fairly affluent, well-educated family, we understood how to get access and how to navigate the system. I can only imagine how many children there are that didn't receive the kind of transformative intervention that my daughter received. And that agitates me a lot. Okay? So that was a story. Does that make sense? Okay, so could the facilitators at the tables raise your hand? So the folks who are facilitating, they're going to help you have this conversation. Enjoy. We'll do this for a little bit. Make sure everybody should talk for 2 to 3 minutes. This isn't a long story, but you know, and nobody has to do it if you don't feel like it's something you want to do. It's not confidential.
No, it's confidential out of this room.
You know, you're telling a public story with people that you may or may not know, so.
I was meant to say you said it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But actually, I don't want any, if anybody, don't share a story that you're not willing to share now in your synagogue in this moment, because it is a public moment. We're all here. So it's actually not confidential. So if there's something you don't want to share because you wouldn't want to share it in a confidential environment, then don't share it. All right? Is that fair? Okay. Okay. And I'll explain why more in a little while. Okay. Al? Let's take a deep breath. I would like to invite this is a good thing. This is a good thing, right? The fact that your conversations don't want to stop is a good thing. So it's, I think, an affirmation. I think it's an affirmation that telling our stories and sharing our concerns as a habit of synagogue life is a good thing. And invariably, when I cut it off, people say, well, we're not done. We want to talk to each other. And I say, so good. Go ahead. Just not right now. Okay. So particularly for some folks that experienced this morning for the first time, who weren't here yesterday, any reactions, feelings to begin with? How did that feel? Okay, go ahead. What's the feeling? You felt not alone. Okay, good. Yeah.
I felt supported. Like, I felt like people wanted to try to see. You know, they understood. And they sort of were taking it beyond, like, in a way that what I was seeing, hearing everybody talk at the table, was that even though people had different experiences, that there were sort of common themes that I think that other people in the world go through. And that maybe we're supposed to be working with people, you know, after hearing everything, that it would be a good idea to get people that have similar themes, similar kind of feelings about issues together, to work together.
Right. This woman is always five steps ahead. You're absolutely right. Right. Eventually, it's about how we can bring together people with common themes and do work together. But that's great reflection. So I'm feeling connected, I'm feeling supported, and I'm finding commonalities. What else? Other feelings that you had going through this exercise? Other reactions? Anger, good. What was that about?
Kindness, anger. You know, it was based on the conversations, but it's just, you know, can you do a better job? Why aren't you doing a better job? Particularly on this table, we're talking about parenting. You know, nobody was putting the blame on anybody, but you kind of want to.
Yeah. How often are we in a place where, like, we get into conversations where we feel some anger? Right, normally it's polite, right? It's polite. Hi, how are you? Fine, everything's fine. This kind of conversation, you feel some support, you feel some, but you also feel a little bit of anger. Things are not as they should be. And anger in a community organizing mode is not a bad thing. Hot anger is a bad thing. Hot anger is when you lash out. In organizing, we talk about cold anger, reflective anger, anger that drives us through our passion to do good in the world, to make a change, to get together with other people who have this similar kind of stirring So, well, if it doesn't need to be this way, what could it be like? So I actually love that you shared the two comments, both of feeling connected to other people and a little bit angry. That's helpful. I saw a new hand here.
Frustration. Frustration that people have problems, and frustration that it takes so long even to hear the story and get the questions out, let alone a resolution.
Right. Nothing is quick that's deep. Right? Things that are deep and real and sustainable take a lot of time, and it's frustrating. It's frustrating. By the way, I should say, and for, especially for the people who are new, the major kind of transformations that happen in the community that I come from, like universal health care in Massachusetts, or affordable housing construction, or the nursing care story, happened over 10 years of organizing. So 10 years of telling stories and building relationships, right? 10 worthy years in the lives of the people that now live in those homes, are in those nursing homes, or have health insurance and have health insurance, but it's frustrating, okay? And that's okay. Other young people, teens in the back, how'd that feel?
Sort of put things in perspective.
How so?
Well, we were talking about personal experiences and then the bigger picture of it. So it was interesting to look at it.
Can
you repeat those?
Yeah, she basically said it put everything in perspective. She sort of understood her own self in the context of something much bigger than herself. Okay. All right. Yeah,
it struck me at our table that we're all at slightly different stages in terms of our ages and our children, but the overlap in the themes and the continuity of concerns among people who are of slightly different ages struck me as these are recurring issues. This is not like something limited to, you know, people in their 30s or people in their 40s. These are things that continue throughout life.
Beautiful. Part of organizing is bringing together communities so that people learn how to stand for the whole, right? So that people at one life stage are standing together with people at a different life stage and fighting together for things that they have in common because of their shared story, okay? So let me move into, yeah, last comment, yeah.
There was a feeling I had at this table of compassion because we were listening to their high school experiences. It all resonated with us. They were tense because there's so much growth out. We're starting to feel tense, and there was a lot of shared emotion at this table.
The non-teens at that table, what did you hear from the teens who were at your table? I'm just curious. How would you interpret what you heard?
A very single-minded message about how terribly stressed they are, how important it is right now to do as well as they could possibly do to get into a good college. And, you know, just all of the pressures that they are under.
Who was with me this yesterday afternoon? Does that sound familiar? Okay, we did a whole piece about Temple Shalom in Newton, which is a suburb a lot like Chappaqua, and the way the teens did their own organizing campaign and built enough power to put pressure on the mayor, the candidates for mayor, to begin to respond to some of teen concerns around stress, overwork, and the way that the teens in that community are stretched between school and activities and religious institutions and all the expectations to get sort of all these different institutions in the room together and say, we got to have a say over what you all demand of us. So the purpose of this morning is to lift up some ways in which this work looks like from the perspective of young people, some kids and teens. So first let me tell a story, and then I'm going to save for the very end, if we have time, a specific other example. And people who were there yesterday, who was there yesterday who heard the teen stress story? You might want to check in with some of the youth groupers who are here and sort of tell them what you heard and talk about a little bit about what's possible here. Rabbi Milliman was there as well, so you can... So this is a story about Temple Israel of Boston, which I tell a lot of stories because they've been organizing for a long time, and it's where I belong, and where David's mother, her memory for a blessing, was an active leader for many, many years, and even knitted for my daughters when they were born. So I have a very, I learned community from people like David's mother. Her memory for a blessing, she was a great lady. But it particularly will resonate for the reason that you'll understand in a second. So, during all the cycles of one-on-one conversations and house meetings, the leadership of the congregation asked itself if we were really organizing around what our families really think and care about, we will figure out how to include our families who are moving towards Bar and Bat Mitzvah in this process. So it isn't just the empty nesters or just the sort of activist types and or just the leaders, that the adult leaders of the congregation, we're really going to get into that core constituency. And so we asked ourselves, what would it look like to engage the 5th, 6th, and 7th grade family population in community organizing? And so we said, well, what if we got in that population, and starting around 5th grade, we started doing house meetings with the families and just start to sort of have them talk about the stresses of their lives and the things that they're concerned about. And lots of interesting things came out of that. We did lots of exercises, like asking people some of the questions like we asked you, asking parents to talk to their kids about injustices that they had experienced in their life and what they had done about it, so that kids were beginning to learn their own parents' stories that they hadn't even heard. And kids started to do, in the fifth grade, some exercises around their own experiences, their own frustrations, and their own lives. And interestingly enough, we began to hear among a catchment of kids an interesting story, which was embodied by the story of Hanny Yarmolinsky. Okay, Hanny Yarmolinsky was a fifth grader at the time, and she and her friends, at their sort of small group meeting, were concerned about seniors and the frail elderly. And this came out of some people, some kids who were saying that their grandparents were not going to be at their bar bat mitzvah celebrations, either because they were too frail to travel or because they'd already passed. They sort of had this, it led to a conversation about how the temple was so dichotomized that the senior population and the kid population never really talked to each other. And they made a decision as they were beginning to, and we started to ask the question, if you were going to honor your bar bat mitzvah by really engaging with the world around you, what might you do? Right? And the stories were stories that were going to lead to the things that they might do. And they decided that they would start to do a series of one-on-one conversations and house meetings with seniors in the congregation and hear their stories and build relationships with them. Now, so far, so good. It's basically a mitzvah project, right? I mean, you know, visiting homebound seniors. This is a good thing to do, but it's still a mitzvah project, which is not a bad thing. But remember, this is in a community organizing mode, right? So the kids and their parents were trained around how to build relationships and uncover stories. And so they started to do a whole set of things where they would bring seniors and kids together, and they would have the seniors tell the stories about why they joined the congregation and what it was like when they were growing up and all this wonderful stuff. And they started to visit the seniors who were homebound, who could no longer come to temple and bring them Shabbat dinners and celebrate in their lives. So Hannah is in the home of one homebound senior, who's no longer able to come to the temple, and they create a nice, meaningful relationship. And in one of their conversations, Hannah asks this older woman why she doesn't come to temple anymore. And it obviously caused, you know, this person a bit of pain, and she said, well, I really can't get down the stairs of my house anymore. So Hannah's in fifth grade, right? Hannah asks a very simple question, right? Well, why don't you move? And the woman said to her, because I can't afford to. So Hannah, who is very much part of our community organizing effort, her and her fifth grade friends, comes to a convening of about 50 leaders in the congregation, because periodically during all the house meetings, there are these check-back sessions where people are sharing, what stories are you hearing out in the congregation? And can we find the commonalities and the themes? And Hannah gets up to report this story. And she asks the question, how could it be that a member of this temple can't afford to move? Now, this comes in the context, right, where other people are telling lots of other stories. Like Fran Godin, who got up and told the story about being concerned that her kids were not going to raise grandchildren in this community because they couldn't afford to buy and they were going to move to North Carolina. And other parents who would share the frustration of trying to get to their kid's school to have a meeting with the kid's teacher. But by the time they could get there, the teacher was always gone. And when asking the teacher why they run out of school when the bell rings, it's because they live an hour and 15 minutes away, which is the cheapest place that they could find. And there was a recognition that we really had a crisis around affordable housing in our community. That the common theme with Hanny Yarmolinsky visiting her homebound senior friend and the grandparents who weren't going to see their grandchildren, parents who couldn't get to their teacher, was part of a public problem, which is why I shared earlier that they shouldn't be confidential stories, that these are really the stories that are public stories of what are happening in our lives that feel like they're personal, but are actually communal. Because the private suffering around a member of our own congregation who couldn't afford to move, and families in our community who are being priced out of their own neighborhoods, was a public problem that required a public solution. Now, this congregation was not alone. It's part of an interfaith organization which has 50 other religious institutions. And in those other religious institutions, doing their house meetings and their one-on-ones, they were also surfacing stories around the lack of affordable housing in Greater Boston. Very similar kinds of stories. And it wasn't that we were the only congregation that had frail elders that had been priced out of the housing market and couldn't move and were locked into their homes. This was happening all over our region, and young people were moving away, and grandparents were mourning the loss of grandchildren in their neighborhood, and there was a recognition that affordable housing was a very much shared communal public story. So now I want to fast forward, because I want to lift up how very much this really is work that is political in nature and is not just about mitzvah projects. It really is about holding our elected leaders accountable to our values and to our public concerns. So fast forward about a year, Hannah is now in sixth grade. So she is on the eve of her bat mitzvah, okay? And there is an assembly in the chapel of the synagogue with 300 people in the room. And 200 of the people in the room are members of this synagogue, and 100 are representatives from the other churches with whom we work. And assemblies like this are going on all over the region. There's a few churches and a couple of synagogues hosting different, what we call actions like this, where in front of the 300 people, all the state representatives and senators who represent our districts are on the bima, seated in a row. There were 7 of them there. So you can imagine the atmosphere, right? It's a chapel that seats 250 people. There's 300 people in the room. It is 200 members of our synagogue, which is a fairly high-powered congregation. Packed into this room, you have 7 state representatives and senators, and folks from our congregation get up and tell their stories. Fran gets up and talks about mourning the loss of grandchildren in her community because there isn't affordable housing for them to live in. And teachers talk about what it's like to leave school every day and have to drive an hour and 15 minutes to get to an affordable community. And then Hannah Yarmolinsky gets up. And she says, in celebrating my bat mitzvah, my social justice project was to become part of this community organizing effort and create relationships with frail seniors. And in those conversations, I learned that there are members of this community who cannot afford to move and can't come to their synagogues or get out of their houses anymore. And she told the story about how agitational it was for her to be in conversation. And her friends in her now sixth grade cohort were all seated together as a caucus at this meeting. And then she did what we call the pin. She turned to the 7 state representatives and senators and said, "Now will you each commit to vote yes for the $100 million state housing trust fund?" What do you think they did?
Said yes.
They all said yes. And they did it. And then, because organizing is not something you do and say, okay, we're done, when there was a new governor who was elected who slashed the $100 million Affordable Housing Trust Fund, we had to reorganize, reassemble with new leaders and new stories, have another assembly, and this time we got it to be a $250 million Affordable Housing Trust Fund. So how do you interpret the story? What happened? Yeah.
They know that that's going to be like, it's not just some older people or people that are like, you know, middle-aged. Look at these people, like that's the future.
Okay, so they were moved and stirred by Hannah's youth. No question about it. But why did the 7 state reps and senators say yes?
Votes.
Yeah, political power. Okay, Hannah's parents vote. 300 people in that community vote. And the way it works in Massachusetts, I don't know, New York State Assembly seems so functional, so maybe this doesn't work here. Massachusetts has 2-party rule, okay? The corrupt Democrats and the Democrats that are less corrupt. And at the time, there was a very powerful Speaker of the House who since has gone to jail. But this Speaker of the House, the way he operated was the following. He would say to every rep and senator, "You vote with me 100% of the time, and I'll give you 3 goodies. You tell whatever your 3 goodies are, I'll give it to you, but you vote with me 100% of the time." You couldn't get anything done in Massachusetts unless the speaker wanted it. So what our interfaith organization understood was that to make real change, we had to have enough senators and representatives pushing back. We had to get a reaction from them to react with him. And part of what happened when all of these reps and senators were getting squeezed between their constituency that actually elect them and this guy who was a power broker, the whole system broke wide open. The reason I tell the story is, in the center of all of that was a 6th grade girl working towards her bat mitzvah and her friends. And it shifted our understanding of how you celebrate a bat mitzvah through social justice, right? It's very easy to imagine a world in which you celebrate through community service, which is not a bad thing. Community service is a good thing. But Hannah discovered in herself that she could be part of the powerful political process of making real systemic change. And when I say Hannah, Hannah becomes a metaphor for all the kids in her cohort. So I have about 15 minutes left, so I want to close by people, when I used to tell the story a couple of years ago, people would say, well, where is Hannah now? So fast forward a couple of years, and again, it's not just Hannah, it's Hannah and her friends, okay? Hannah and her sisters. So do you bring your young people to the RAC?
Yes, we do.
Have you guys been to Washington to the RAC?
They're going this year.
Are you going this year? Okay, great. Okay. So I every year would bring, you know, my 30 youth groupers, which Hannah became one of, and we would go to the Religious Action Center in Washington, and it'd be great. We'd learn about all kinds of Jewish issues and Jewish perspectives on social justice issues, and then you'd go lobby. So we happen to be in Newton, Massachusetts, so who do we get to go lobby? Kennedy, Kerry, and Frank. Okay, so, you know, there is not a lot of tension. Unless you know Barney Frank. Do you know Barney Frank?
Yes.
Not an easy person. Not an easy person. So the kids go in there, and we sort of had prepared. We said, look, Congressman Frank's a little bit difficult. So first kid gets up. They're practiced, they're prepared, they've studied these issues. The first things they want to lobby on is AIDS funding. And this came from the kids, right? There's a whole thing where the kids get to study the issues, pick what they want to do. So youth group representative number one gets up and says, I'm so-and-so from Temple Israel in Boston, representing 1,800 families from Newton, da-da-da-da. So there's power in the room, right? Because this kid represents a constituency of Barney Frank's. I would like to talk to you today about AIDS funding. Don't you tell me about AIDS funding! Who the heck do you think I am? I've been fighting for gay rights and AIDS funding, da-da-da. This poor kid go like pale, okay? And we got into 30 minutes of this kind of like the kids who had practiced and prepared would get up there and would go through this thing with this liberal, progressive, blah, blah, blah. And we finally, the thing ends, and the guy, by the way, he's sitting there with his feet on his desk with no shoes on. And what does that show, by the way?
Disrespect.
So we get out of the room and we make a circle, because in community organizing we always debrief and evaluate everything that we do. So I say to the kids, how are you feeling? There's this pause, and Hannah's in the circle. And a couple of them say, relieved. Thank God it's over. We survived. Now, Hannah's a community organizer by now. She's really been trained. So I said, Hannah, what do you think of that? And she goes, this is ridiculous. What do you mean relieved? What do you mean survived? He works for us. Our parents elected him. We may agree on issues, but there was a lack of respect and recognition. These are going to be people who in 2 years can vote or not vote for him. And he showed them a lack of respect. So I said what any community organizer would say, right? What do you ask when a group of people are frustrated and angry? What are you going to do about it? So they said, okay. As they started to do, you know, they decided when they got back to Boston, they ran a series of house meetings with their teen peers. And asked the question, you know, what are you frustrated about? And there was a deep, widespread frustration that they didn't have the power to vote. So they understood that if they wanted to build more political clout with people like Congressman Frank, they needed to have more electoral power. So they said, well, we can't vote ourselves. But what if we did a campaign to get voting commitments? So the next time we meet with Frank, we can say, we represent X number of people and 1,000 commitments to vote on this agenda. So they did a voter registration and voter commitment drive where they ran a series of house meetings and one-on-one conversations and phone banking to raise commitments to vote and to get people to vote on a particular platform of their concerns. Now, you got to imagine, you know, hi, you know, hello, yes, this is, what's your name? Becky. Okay, this is Becky. Becky Hameroff, right? I'm from your congregation. But, oh, Becky, yeah, that's right. I know your mom. Yeah, that's right. What can I do for you? Well, I'm calling to make sure you're going to vote. Of course, Becky, of course I'm going to vote. And I want to make sure you're going to take into consideration the very much important, you know, issue of health reform this year. Wow. Okay, Becky, sure, I will. Click, right? 2,000 commitments to vote. 2,000 commitments to vote. So that the young people of this congregation began to understand themselves as political players with power to have agency over their lives, so that elected officials understood that they actually had agency and that they had clout. Okay? We only have about 10 minutes left, so let me pause. Questions, comments, reactions, particularly on the question about in a community organizing mode, how do you engage young people in the process? Yes?
That would be, that's the first question. But the second, my reaction is that teenagers are very angry in a lot of ways, and they feel that they don't have power. Like, the table, they have to study and they have to do. And I mean, I put a different kind of reference, frame of reference on my daughter. I knew that even though she could do a certain amount, I gave her like an in-between kind of level, so she wouldn't be under, and she doesn't have to achieve over. She can do like her thing.
Right, so then the question, of course,
but the thing is, I also know that she's angry in other ways. I can see her and her friends and things that they've done, and I think it's out of anger. And now my reaction to all this is, I feel that a lot of times teenagers don't know what to do because they have certain things that's private, or they might feel that they don't have that much power. They can't vote. They can't do this. They can't do that. But it's much more than just some of these misfit projects. It has to do with the power.
Right. Let me just because we don't have a lot of time, let me just engage with you by suggesting the following. The number one thing you can do to engage teens in community organizing is get out of the way. Don't tell them what they ought to do. Don't tell them what the project is. Let some organizer or youth director or rabbi, hope you left, who understands something about organizing, let them create a leadership team and do their own internal listening campaign where they decide what they want to do. Right? Because as soon as we come in with an agenda and say, oh, you ought to volunteer at this or you ought to be doing that, they're going to say, well, that's just one more pressure you're putting on me. We had a whole conversation yesterday about why do people show up? Because it's... because it matters to them. Because they're angry or passionate enough about something that they're willing to do something about it. The reason why we have some teens who are struggling under pressure is there's lots of agendas coming at them from other people. Other institutions have decided for them, this is what you ought to care about and do. Organizing gives everyone, whether you're a senior citizen or you're a teenager or a bat mitzvah kid, space to figure out, how do I want to exercise my power over my universe? How do I want to act with agency over my own life? Okay, yes?
One thing I ask you, how can you handle conflicts within the Jewish group in terms of policy with respect to population control? I mean, we all know that the Catholic Church is opposed to abortion, but within Judaism, there are great differences of opinion about abortion.
So it's a great question. Thank you for the question. Organizing, as I said earlier, is about standing for the whole. So you can only stand together when you are the whole. And there are certain things that you say, we can't organize around this. So for example, in the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which is this 50 religious institutions that I told you about, of which there are Catholic congregations and African American Episcopal and abortion, gay marriage, this can't be done. So even within the Jewish world, right? In one round of house meetings and one-on-ones we ran through, it was just after Ariel Sharon had gone to the Temple Mount and sparked the Second Intifada. And so lots of people were talking about Israel, lots of stories. And so we sort of broke down into small groups to talk about, well, what do we want to do around Israel, and discovered we were a congregation divided. And so the most that we could do in acting together was to honor and celebrate ourselves as a community that made space for differing opinions about this issue. Matt?
Joe, the program is obviously based on faith-based, community-based organizing. There's a lot of, junior high school kids and high school kids out there who just don't think Temple is cool, right? So how does your program attempt to reach those individuals, if at all? Do you work with public high schools? Do you work with public institutions, non-denominational institutions?
Great question.
In order to attract them?
There's a conventional maxim. This came up yesterday, too, in a different context. You organize who's in the room. Right? You organize who shows up. So, because that's where you've got people. And organizing all about organized people working together. I have definitely seen an uptick in the congregations that really do engage teens well, in more teens coming in, because they say, here's something that's alive, that matters, that's relevant in my life. But the whole point is leveraging organized constituencies of people. So for me, I can't spend my time and energy running around one person at a time saying, hey, do you want to be part of this? We look at synagogues with people that show up, with kids that show up, and we organize them. So the answer is, you're right, there's a lot of energy out there, and others could do that work, but that's not what we do. We really focus on reforms. Others do, the churches and others do conservative synagogues. We do reform synagogues, and who's there? Yeah.
Two-part question, and probably both of them are rhetorical. One.
So he's going to make a statement. Let's just be clear.
How do we learn how to listen to teens? Part one. Part two. How do we learn how to listen to teens without being judgmental?
That's a rhetorical. How do we learn to listen to teens, and how do we learn to listen without being judgmental? We have some experts in the room. You guys want to... Any insight, guys?
I guess I could say just think of this as another bad as another adult.
Yeah, not you are.
What are you guys kidding?
She said something very important.
Yeah.
Did you hear? Did everybody hear?
No.
Just talk to us like another human. She said talk to us like an adult. I would say, you know, these are two human beings. Have a conversation. Why would you change, right, the way that you relate? Think about the relationship between Hannah and this octogenarian. It was an absolutely reciprocal, right? They could build power together because they were equals with one another. Okay? Any other reflections, teens or young people or... Sorry, ouchies. Sure. I think you get the last word, and then we're going to close.
Within the Jewish group, only, leaving out any other religious group, what, if anything, is being done by Reform Judaism to make the Orthodox group more liberal and
Forget it.
I invite you to ask Rabbi Davidson next Friday night to preach that sermon. Not my concern, not my world. I mean, it's just not what I do. It's just not what I do.
Yeah, but you're talking about discrimination, right?
Talking about?
You're talking about standard of life, housing, and so on. Even working in groups, let's say, for a particular project.
Look, there's an open invitation. There's an open
Judaism to let girls participate with boys equally.
You know, I worry about the Reform world. I can't worry about it. I have enough trouble with you guys. No, I mean, look, you know, in our work, we would invite any Orthodox synagogue that...
It's a political decision you make.
Yeah, that's right. Because everybody has, you know, limited resources, limited time. That's, you know, that's, I leave it to them.
Just one question about your experience, because you said that you do this around the country, Dallas, Chicago. Do you find that the themes in these discussions are similar everywhere, or do you find that there are some differences when you go from region to region?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there are big, big baskets of things that it's shocking to me how similar they are. You know, I mean, you know, right now in the country, there's campaigns all over the country on healthcare. That's just not a surprise. People are really struggling with their school systems. That's not a surprise. If you're down in the Southwest, a lot of concern about immigration. Because if you live in Phoenix or Texas or California, it's just right there. And increasingly, I think a realization, there was a conventional wisdom that you didn't really work with young people because you want power, so you work with who has power, which is the older adults, but increasingly a recognition of the importance of engaging young people in the work. And the whole environmental question is an interesting one because it hadn't been understood until the last few years as an economic issue as well. Most campaigns that emerge around economic inequities. And increasingly, there's an understanding of the relationship between environmental issues and economic disparities. But yeah, I mean, you know, so the, what ends up happening is you cut your local issue very narrowly to be what's appropriate. So if you work on the environment in Chappaqua, it's going to look very different than what they're doing in Manhattan. But there are moments when you might stand together as a whole and do something statewide. Right? Okay. With that, I'm going to say one last word, which is just that I want to lift up the sort of history and the making that's happening in your neighborhood in two ways. You know, community organizing in this mode has been going on since the 1930s in Chicago. Saul Alinsky, who started all of this, was a Jew, never stepped foot in synagogue. And for most of the 60 or 70 years in the beginning, there weren't synagogues or Jews at the table. In the last 10 years, there's been a real sea change where the Jewish community has really rolled up its sleeves and joined together with the Christian community to make something powerful happen in cities and communities across America. But it's also true that in the suburban world, much more so, suburbanites are joining together with each other and then with their urban neighbors and saying, how can we act collectively to transform the communities and the regions and the states in which we live? What's historic here is that as of right now, there's not an interfaith group in Chappaqua that does this kind of community organizing work yet. But there are 50 institutions who are talking about what would it mean to be a suburban Westchester organization that would build power to make real change, that would be cross-class, cross-religion, cross-racial. And it has largely been sparked by the leadership and the vision of the Reform rabbis of Westchester, including your own rabbis. So that if you get there, and there is this kind of real transformative effort that takes place, it will go down in American history as the first time that there was a real broad-based community organizing effort that started with a Reform Jewish community in the suburbs. And I think that's really worth celebrating. So thank you for being part of that.
I just want to take a moment as we close to do a couple of things. The first is, I just want to make sure that everybody signed one of the sign-up sheets and that the facilitators make sure to get those at the end. And a couple of thank yous just to repeat, but they are very much